Okay, fun seekers, we got a task to do today. We are going to do our best to get our arms around this 800-pound marshmallow called the mutual fund industry. And we're going to do that by looking at the various categories of mutual funds, from the riskiest to the least risky. It's not an easy task because these are the largest or most overarching categories. There are subcategories and subcategories and subcategories. The industry has exploded, as we saw in our first presentation. So be ready. But the ones that we discuss are the only ones that you need to emphasize, that you need to study. And as you become more and more familiar with investments and the mutual fund industry as a whole, you will see that there are just variations on these same themes that we use. Now, it would behoove you, it would be a good idea for you to have the mutual fund scramble sheet. And we always have this when we do the face-to-face class, we always have this handed out to the students, and we build it on the board because there's a few things we do with the scramble sheet that we really don't want to do with the presentation here because it would just make it look really messy. But stop right now and make sure you get it, print it out, or have it on the screen so that you can refer to it. Okay? Because we're going to start with stock mutual funds because those, for the general categories, are the riskiest. And we're going to go from the most riskiest stocks to the least riskiest stocks. Okay, so even though remembering all stocks are fairly risky, there are, as we saw in the stock world, some stocks that are riskier than others. And so we start with our spectrum of risk versus return with aggressive growth stocks. The truth is there are actually one or two categories above these aggressive growth mutual funds that we don't even want to mention, but there they are, Momentum, Ultra, they go by various names. And these are the most riskiest of stock funds. We're looking for eye-popping returns, but we know we're going to get a whole lot of risk, or volatility, which is a fancy way of saying, oh my goodness, look how much money I lost. You got it? Now, I don't know if this makes sense, but if it does, use it. If it doesn't, don't. But I like to think of mutual funds like a buffet. You go to the buffet. Do you load up your plate with all cayenne peppers or jalapenos or... No, I mean, some people probably do, but no. We take a little bit of the spice, a little bit of the very spicy, picante sauce and foods. Because we know that if we ate all of them, we're probably not going to be loving life for long. And some people, that they don't seem to bother them, and they can take the risk, the danger. But for the vast majority of us, no. We put a little bit on our plate. So maybe 5-10%, if we're doing a 401k allocation, a little bit. The next category are growth stock mutual funds. These invest primarily in growth stocks. And yes, they tend to be risky, but not as risky as the aggressive growth world of mutual funds. But of course, every mutual fund is different, so you have to do in-depth research. You have to know your mutual funds inside out, compare them to others in their categories, and then make your decision. Does that make sense? Now, on the mutual fund scramble sheet, you see the next category written around the aggressive growth and the growth categories. And that's called capital appreciation. Well, Piano, isn't capital appreciation basically the same as growth? Well, yes and no, because there's a very subtle difference between a capital appreciation stock and a growth stock mutual fund. The growth stock mutual fund says, hey, if you look in the in the prospectuses, which people don't do, it'll say something along the lines of, we will be primarily invested in growth stocks, and up to at least 80% of our portfolio will be growth stocks. Whereas a capital appreciation fund will be much more flexible. They will say, look, we don't really care if we invest in growth stocks. What we're interested in is growing the capital. It's just making it go up, making the value of the mutual fund go up. So we may pick growth stocks. We may pick defensive stocks or cyclical stocks or out of favor stocks, the turnarounds, if we believe that there's an opportunity for capital appreciation. Do you see the subtle difference? Exactly. We back in chapter 12, we talked about growth stocks versus defensive stocks versus cyclical versus turnarounds. And so blue chips and income stocks, as long as the capital appreciation fund believes that they can grow the capital, that they can make the value of the fund go up, it will invest in those, which is very different than a growth or aggressive growth mutual fund, which says, hey, we're going to be primarily invested in companies that are growing their dividends. Now, here's what you're up against. One of the most successful and long-lived capital appreciation funds is called the Growth Fund of America. It's the one we highlighted back in chapter 12. Now, wait a minute. How were they allowed to do that? If you went to the Growth Fund of America and say, why don't you call yourself the Capital Appreciation Fund of America? They would turn around and say, hey, look, we were the Growth Fund of America before the capital appreciation term phrase became into existence. So why don't you change the name of your, you see, this is how difficult things are. The very famous Fidelity Magellan Fund, run by Peter Lynch from 1977 till 1989, I'm sorry, 12 years, was a capital appreciation fund, which meant Mr. Peter Lynch could basically look anywhere he wanted to. Small companies, large companies, medium-sized companies, turnarounds, blue chips, goners, defensive growth companies, and he was very good at just picking out the best companies at a very, you know, reasonable price. So that's what you're up against. In practice, capital appreciation funds tend to be as risky as growth funds, but not always. The next category, and my personal favorite category, and if you were to be asked on an exam, which would you choose? If you chose growth and income, you wouldn't get any argument from me, but you can choose whatever you want because it's your money. We want growth. That's what stocks give us, right? But we also want dividends, income. We want income from our stocks. So that's why it's sometimes called a blend fund. We want growth and we want dividends. And sometimes they will invest in bonds. If they can't find really good dividends from stocks, they might invest in bonds. But for the most part, they're going to invest mostly in stocks that are growing. Yes, we want growth, but we also want dividends. And some look for growing dividends. They love companies that grow their dividends over time. You may even see people use the term value, but we have to be careful because value in the investment world often takes a connotation that is much more narrower. Whereas a growth and income stock mutual fund, it can invest in growth stocks. They can invest in dividend payers. Value companies, value mutual funds tend to look for companies that are selling at a discount to what they believe they're worth. And usually these are not the growing companies. So we have to be very careful, although you will see them lumped in with growth and income funds. So now what's this? What's the growth and income funds? This is the pasta. This is the meat and potatoes. This is the main entree that you fill up 50% or more on your plate. You with me? This is the main, in my humble opinion, especially for younger folks who really don't need bonds. This is where I start them. This is where I recommend, you know, that then they decide. I show them growth and I'll show them things that are less risky. But this is where I believe most people should be. And this is where I still have the most money in personally. I have some in growth, I have some in the less risky stuff, but I love the combination of growth and income. But that's everyone's different, right? Some people like the aggressive growth. Some people want something even less, much less risky than growth and income. And then the last category, and notice I on the scramble sheet, I tried to make value and blend go around growth and income because they're associated with, but depending on the company you look at, it might be very different than another company's definition. That's what you're up against. The last category in the stock group is called equity income. Now, why did they call it that? I don't know, but they did because equities mean stocks and income from stocks is dividend. Why don't they just call it a stock dividend mutual fund? Don't ask me. I don't know. I didn't make up the decision. But these mutual funds will emphasize companies that pay dividends, such as food companies and railroads and utilities. Yes, you understand? Remember the defensive companies we talked about? Exactly. They're still stock funds, so don't get me wrong. They'll go down when the market goes down, but they're going to be less risky, far less risky than an aggressive growth stock, if they're done well. I'll never forget back in the heyday of the bubble of the 1990s, late 1990s, the Janus Equity Income Fund. And somebody asked me about it, and I looked at it, and I looked at what they were buying, and I said, this is not an equity income fund. And the prospectus even said, you know, don't think we're an equity income fund. They didn't say it that way, but they basically said, you know, be prepared for much more volatility. And sure enough, anybody who bought this thinking they were getting a real equity income fund basically got, you know, they didn't get what they thought they were getting because it went down like the growth funds and the aggressive growth funds in the 2000 to 2002 bear market. So as we said before, if we look at the, one last thing about equity income. What is the equity income in our buffet analogy? Oatmeal. Yeah. Is oatmeal exciting? Well, you put a little bit of cinnamon on it. Maybe no. It's kind of boring, but it's good for you. Look what it does for horses. You know, big, beautiful animals. They eat oats. So, everybody else is partying, drinking heavily, eating the desserts and the spicy food and having a good old time. The equity income funds are sort of just sitting there in the corner eating their oatmeal. But then when things go bad, right, the equity income funds will shine. Yes, exactly. Okay, so now, at the bottom of the slide, as we said, these classifications are just some of the major types of stock mutual funds. There are many, many more, folks. But if you get these five categories and their cohorts, you'll have a good idea of what can be offered through stocks. Slide number 10. Now we're going to make it more interesting because don't forget slide number 9. Don't forget we learned on slide number 9, but we're going to superimpose more categories on top of them. Remember the capitalization, large cap, mid cap, small cap? Exactly. We're going to say, look, we want a mutual fund that invests just in large companies or mid-sized companies or small companies. And of course, which do you think is the riskiest? Small companies are much more risky than large companies. Why? Because when there's a storm, when there's a market correction, a downturn, a crash, a recession, whatever, small company stocks tend to get hit the hardest. Why? Because they just don't have the roots deep into the economy, and it's harder for them to survive. Whereas the large companies have those resources. And of course, mid-cap is somewhere in the middle. But when the recession is over, when the sky's clear, small companies tend to do much, much better. Why? Because first of all, they got knocked down harder than the other guys. But they're also more nimble. They can adjust and move quickly, change their company much more quickly than a large company could to adjust to changing conditions. So that's the trade-off. And then there's a yet another categorization called domesticity. Where is the company based? Is it based in the US? Or is it based anywhere in the globe? Or is it based outside the United States? So this is a little tricky, and you must know it because remember, you're the guru for your friends and family. Global means anywhere around the globe, anywhere in the world, including the United States. Whereas international, sometimes called foreign, means anything outside the United States. So we're going to superimpose yet another category on top of our stock funds. So which do you think is the riskiest? Well, many years ago, folks, and we're talking many years ago, 40, 50 years ago, certainly domestic companies, domestic mutual funds, were considered much less riskier than international, with global being somewhere in the middle. But this is not true anymore. It's just not true anymore. The world is global, folks. We tend to think of companies like Coca-Cola and Microsoft and Apple as domestic companies. Yeah, they're based in the U.S., but they do more business outside the United States than they do inside the United States. I mean, Coca-Cola is based in Atlanta, but if every single United Stater decided they weren't going to drink fizzy sugar water with a brown crayon dipped in it, Coca-Cola, they'd still have 80% of their revenue and earnings coming from outside the United States. They'd still be a large cap, huge company, multinational. So it's just not true anymore. Yes, certainly, as you get into the smaller economies, and something's called the emerging economies or developing economies, yes, there's still a great deal of risk, but it's not true, and it's just not as true as it used to be. So here you are, folks. Pick one from column A, one from column B, and one from column C. And so you wind up with a domestic large cap growth and income fund or a global small cap growth fund. And so you see how the industry could explode into 12,000 different mutual funds, because every company, if one company came out with an international mid-cap equity income fund, then all of them have to do it. And part of this was spurred during the 1990s and 2000s and 1980s also by a company called Morningstar, which created these style boxes. Is it a large cap, domestic, and it was a three-dimensional grid, actually a two-dimensional grid, but a 3D grid, three-column grid by three-column grid. And so I guess some companies said, forget it, we're not playing this game. But many other companies just kept adding funds and funds and funds and funds. So now you company like Fidelity, which we're going to take a look at in our next presentation, they have almost 500 funds of their own. So, I don't think it's in the best interest of most investors to just have so many different choices, but that's me. Other people believe differently. Now, also, and here's yet another, we probably should have this on its own slide, but we don't need to. We can also have regional funds, companies, mutual funds that are based on buying companies just in Japan or Canada. There's even one fund that just invests in California companies. Why? Because if California were its own country, it'd be the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. So there's plenty to invest in California, but it tends to be more tech oriented. So you're basically buying a tech fund. You could buy a fund just based in Latin America or the Far East. Now, again, we said in the very beginning about mutual funds that we buy mutual funds for professional money management and diversification. So by going regional, by looking at a company that just invests in Canada or Japan or Western Europe or wherever, are we diversifying or are we concentrating our portfolio? I submit to you that we're being more concentrated. And that's fine for, again, a little bit of spice, because if you know that that Latin America is booming, which it was for quite some time, and now they're getting hit hard by COVID also, then you could put a little bit of your portfolio in Latin America, but I prefer just staying global. Investing globally, telling my mutual fund managers, hey, go find the best companies. I don't care where they are. You have a global research team. Find the best companies no matter where they are and invest in them. And then we get into dumb and dumber sector funds. These are funds that invest just in one sector of the economy, such as energy, technology, healthcare, or maybe mining or wireless or leisure, chemicals, oil. Fidelity was the company that pioneered these, but there are others. And they have dozens of these things, folks, dozens of them. Again, are we trying to concentrate or are we trying to diversify? Okay, so you know something about a particular industry. Maybe you work in the energy sector, or maybe you work in wireless or leisure or chemicals or whatever area you work in. Buy a little bit of it, okay? Because, again, that whole sector can get just, right now, energy is just getting clobbered, right? And it's going to come back. You know it's going to come back because our energy needs are not going to change. They're not going to end. They're going to change, you know, how we get our energy. Yes, that's going to change. But, you know, people say the oil industry is going to disappear. Yeah, maybe in 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years. But oil is just too important a commodity to just say it's going to go away. It's not going to go away. Hopefully we'll use a whole lot less in the future. And then the last category is dumber. Market timing, folks. Stay away. Stay far away from anybody who tells you they know how to time the market. As we said back in chapter 12, no one can, don't try to time the market. The only people who can do it are liars, right? Okay. So those were the stock funds. Now we move down the risk versus return spectrum into the bond funds. These are funds that primarily invest in bonds, and they usually will not add any stocks to their mix, as some of the growth and income or the equity income funds might add some bonds for income. No, these guys are going to stay bonds. And it's an old saying, let bond funds be bond funds, because bond funds are boring, folks. Bonds are boring, but they do you well when the market falls, and so you can sleep well with bond funds. You're not going to eat very well. And again, we'll do from the riskiest to the least riskiest. And the riskiest one, and the one I think you should really just stay away from, in my humble opinion, unless, again, you really like spice, are the junk bond funds, high yield bonds, high income funds, sometimes they're called. But these are investing in bonds that are in distress. Remember the junk bonds, the non-investment grade bonds? They're pretty dangerous. And they tend to do well when stocks do well. Why? Because as the economy is improving, companies' earnings are growing, those distressed bonds can be paid off. And so these guys will do well. But what happens when there's a recession? Stocks get cratered, right? Well, so do the junk bonds that are tied to those companies. Because now there's a recession, earnings fall, maybe they won't be able to pay off those bonds. So high yield bond funds tend to follow the stock market. Whereas bond funds, all the other bond funds we're going to look at, tend to work opposite. They are not correlated. That's the fancy word we use with the stock market. They tend to be negatively correlated, which is a really fancy term, which means when stocks go up, bonds tend to go down or stay the same. Whereas when stocks go down, bonds tend to go up. Now, why is that? Well, first of all, people are fleeing out of stocks. They're frightened. Those are the traders, the speculators. Plus, interest rates usually go down in a recession. And what happens when interest rates go down? You are the guru for your friends and family. You have to be able to answer that interest rates go down, bond prices go up. So that's why some people like that mix, right? They like to have eat well with the stocks and sleep well with the bonds. So our next category are the corporate bond funds. And sometimes you'll see, along with this, convertible bonds. We talked about convertible bonds. Very quickly, stay away from them. But corporate bond funds, usually heavily invested in double B, triple B, you know, above, triple B, A, double A, triple A, investment grade, although they may have a little bit of non-investment grade, a little bit of spice in them, depending on the bond fund. And then next category are the muni bonds, the state and local governments issuing bonds to, you know, build schools and trains and bridges and the like. And so here, the bullet train is one of the examples I meant. Not private trains, but these are the bullet train. California is building a bullet train. Did you know that? Yeah, right. I don't know if it'll ever get off the ground, but let's see if it does. Muni bonds have that wonderful feature that they're free of federal income taxes, the interest on them. If you buy a municipal bond fund that specializes in your state, and of course for us it's California, you don't pay the federal income tax, nor do you pay the state income tax. Very, very cool. And then next in the least, these are the least riskiest, are the U.S.-backed and the U.S. bonds. And the U.S.-backed bonds are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and a few other entities that were sponsored by the United States. And for dozens of years, the Congress, who actually sponsored established Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as private companies, kept saying that, no, if they go bankrupt, it's not our problem. We're not going to backstop them. And everybody believed that, yeah, the government would backstop them if anything bad happened. And of course, it did in the great housing bubble and then subsequent Great Recession. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were backstopped by you, dear students, and me, the taxpayers. And actually, it's been a good deal for us. Fannie and Freddie, the two major home loan providers, we never deal directly with them. When you deal with a mortgage broker or a bank or a credit union, usually what they do is they just turn around after you've made the loan and they sell it to Fannie and Freddie. And so we never deal with them, but it's all done behind the scenes. And sure enough, we now own Fannie and Freddie. And for the last 10, 12 years, there's been plenty of discussion of how we're going to extricate ourselves from them, but nobody can agree on how to do it. At the same time, they've been making money for the U.S. government. They've been sending billions of dollars every year to the Treasury because they're very profitable entities. And it's not usually how you want to run a capitalist country, but it's an issue that's going to have to, maybe not, maybe we'll just... Maybe that'll be our little piece of the capitalistic system. Will be owned by the taxpayers, and it's worked, you know, very well, except for the time when we all believed that the housing prices would never go down. And then, of course, the granddaddy of them all, U.S. Treasuries, Treasury bonds, government bonds, the least riskiest. Well, guess what? Just as we did with stocks, we're going to do the same thing with bonds. We're going to overlay two more categories, domesticity is down here. There's the domestic, global, international, but also whether they are long-term bonds, intermediate-term bonds, short-term bonds. Now, which is the riskiest here? Which is the least riskiest? You might think long is kind of like large and short is kind of like small and intermediate is kind of like midterm. No, they're totally different. In the world of bonds, short term is the least riskiest. Huh? And long term is the most riskiest? Why is that, Piano? Well, think about it, folks. If you're lending money and you're lending it for 30 years versus 2 years, because that's short term, you know, 1, 2, 3 years, intermediate, 4, 5, 7 years or so. And long term is 5 to 30 or 40 years. If you're lending your money out for a year or two versus lending your money out for 20 to 30 years, right, there's more chances for things to go wrong in the long term and for interest rates to affect you much harder because it's kind of like a seesaw. Remember the seesaw we talked about in bonds? Interest rates go down, bond prices go up. Interest rates go up, bond prices go down. Well, if you're at the end of the seesaw, that's long term, and somebody is at the bottom of the seesaw and jumps off on the other side, what do? Whoosh, bump, you ran, you fall really far. And that's exactly what happened when interest rates go up. The other side goes up, your side goes down hard. But if you're standing in the middle of the seesaw, and did you ever do that as a kid? That was my favorite spot, to jump on top of the seesaw in the middle and kind of push the other two kids back and forth. If you're in the top, if you're there, which is basically what short-term bonds are, you're only moving a little bit. You're moving a little bit while the long end of the seesaw. I don't know if it makes any sense to you. Think about it, because it's a perfect analogy. It works perfectly. And then, of course, we talked about the domesticity, whether they're domestic, global, international. So this, just as we did with stocks, we're going to overlay one from column A and one from column B and one from column C and wind up with a domestic long-term high-yield bond fund or an international muni bond. Well, no, that wouldn't make sense because we would be buying... Yeah, it would be. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't never seen an international muni bond, but I'm sure they exist. You don't get any tax benefits from them. But other countries have bonds that are paying quite nicely. Mexico has some bonds that I think they're 100-year bonds. I think they came out in 2007. And they don't mature until 2107. And they were priced very attractively. They were giving a good rate of return. So think about it. Think about investing in Mexico. Don't do it. Let the bond managers do it for you, dear students. Slide number two. So those are bond funds. Okay, so we got stock bonds, funds. We got the bond funds. And wait a minute, Piano. Balance funds, stock and bond funds, are less risky than stock and bond funds? That doesn't make any sense. You would think these would be in between them. These funds that invest in stocks and bonds, you would think would be in between a stock and in between a bond fund. And no, you know, in practice, sometimes yes, but they exhibit often less volatility than a stock or a bond fund only. And why is that? Remember what we talked about correlation? Sometimes stocks go down, bonds go up, and vice versa. So if you have a fund that invests in both, it tends to smooth out certainly the bumps of the stock fund, but also the bumps of a bond fund. Very interesting. Now, it doesn't always work out that way, but that's the idea. So we talked about balance funds before, and we'll talk about them again. They tend to allow people to eat well, reasonably, and sleep well, reasonably. And that will be our illustration for this chapter. We'll see how a bond fund, we'll see how a stock and bond fund, a balance fund, has given us certainly better returns than bonds, almost always. I mean, if it's well run and we take the long term, not quite as good as returns as a stock fund, but, you know, pretty good returns compared to the bond fund. So this is one that I think is certainly worthwhile for people when they get older like me. And that's what we've done. My wife and I have moved more of our stock mutual funds into balance funds. And also for people who are just terrified, who just really are terrified of the stock market, even if they're in their 20s, if they're just saying, oh, I don't want to touch it. Well, let me show you what a balance fund can do. You're going to have stocks and bonds, and look how well it's done over the long term. And then they kind of go, oh, okay. But if they really want bonds, I think they're far too young for bonds, but that's their money. And that's why there's chocolate and vanilla, and some people like strawberry. Now, along with the balance funds, lumped in together are these asset allocation funds. Stay away from these folks. All things being equal, they never are. Just look at your individual choices. But asset allocation funds typically will say, look, we know better than everybody else. Which, if someone says that, that's a red flag right there. But they're saying, we believe that we can allocate your assets on a timely basis. We think the stock market is a really, really good deal. We'll put everything into stocks, 100%, and have no bonds and no cash. We think bonds are the best way to go right now. We'll take everything out of stocks, put it into bonds. Or we think stocks and bonds are both dangerous. We'll put it all into cash. This is smacks to me of market timing. It smells like market timing, and it can't be done except by liars. So I stay far away from these asset allocation funds. But again, you have to do your research. You will hear when they talk about balance funds, them marketed as a complete investment program for the prudent investor. And the best balance funds are the ones that stay balanced, in my humble opinion. For example, the one that we profile says that they will never be more than 75% stocks, 25% bonds. So that's when they, my apologies. That's when they believe that the market, the stock market is the best deal, but they'll still have 25% bonds. So they'll have 75% stocks, 25% bonds. And when they think that stocks are overvalued, they can move all the way down to 50% stocks and 50% bonds, but they'll never go more than 50% bonds and they'll never go less than 50% stocks. So they keep the balance. Does that make sense? I hope so. I think so, because I think that's, because you don't know what's going to happen in the future. We just don't know. We can do our best, find the best companies that we think at attractive prices, and look for good quality bonds, but it all could change tomorrow. And then the lead, now, definitely the least riskiest are the money market mutual funds, which we talked about a little bit in Chapter 11. These look like a checking account. They are always a dollar, and the price is always a dollar. They're meant to look like a checking account. So it always looks like you got a checking account going on. Now, there's stuff going on behind the scenes that we don't know about that we can talk about. We talk about more in Business 123 Introduction to Investments. But these are not guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the United States government, but they're pretty darn close. In fact, when there was fear that these things might explode, back in 2008, the Federal Reserve Bank came in on their white horse with their gleaming sword and said, "Don't worry, we will backstop all the money market mutual funds out there for 6 months." And everybody quieted down and said, "Okay, the Federal Reserve Bank, they got all the money in the world," which is the truth. They can create as much money as they want. That's their perk. And they did that for 6 months, and then they extended it for another 6 months. And by the fall of 2009, people were still worried, but not as worried as they were when they were about ready to jump off a cliff. So these things, don't worry about them, folks. You're not going to lose money, but they're not guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. Yes, they are. Anyway, okay, that was the full spectrum. Now, we could have put this on another slide, but I just figured we got plenty of room. Let's do it. Because these things are becoming more and more popular. Why? As we'll talk, we'll say an example in a minute, but and we'll give you an example. But there are mutual funds that invest in other mutual funds. Huh? Sure, I don't mind being charged twice. Well, no, it's not the idea. These mutual funds were created as a solution to the retirement problem, the college education problem. Because companies were putting people or getting people to enroll in their 401k plans, but they did not have the legal authority, nor did they want to take on the fiduciary responsibility of telling people or recommending people what to invest in. Which, you know, you have to be licensed. You have to get your broker's license to be able to do that, or you're committing a crime, believe it or not. But of course, if you talk to your friends about investments, no one's going to bother you. But if you did it for money, they would they'd throw you in jail. So and if you do it, you can get sued, right? Even if you are a broker. And that's why you have what's called errors and omission insurance. If anybody sues you for giving a bad investment, you have insurance so that they'll pay the legal fees and you don't get hit with $10,000 worth of legal fees. So the Congress, and this is something that's good, folks. They said, look, businesses, we understand you don't want to take on the responsibility, nor are you even prepared to do it. We will give you the ability to automatically put your employees into the proper life cycle or retirement date or target date. They go by various names. If the thrift savings plan calls them life cycle, or no, like yeah, life cycle or lifestyle, life cycle, and so they look at your date of birth and they say, look, you have another 40 years until you're ready to retire, so we're going to put you in the 2060 fund. If you have 10 years to retirement, we'll put you in the 2030 fund or 2035, depends on what risky you want to be. You see, and you can choose. You don't have to take these. You can change it. You can change it to whatever you want, but we will automatically put you in those. And the Congress says, you can't sue us. And we're not taking on any fiduciary obligation, financial obligation. We're just doing what the law says we can do. And that's why these things have become very, very popular. Some of them are quite good. Some of them, not so good. But that's true of everything, right? So you have to do your diligence, as it says, do your proper diligence, and see if the life cycle funds in your retirement plan or your college education plan or whatever are good and good for the long term, because that's what we're interested in. But, so you see, they're not part of this spectrum on the risk versus return spectrum, because they, the 2060 is going to be far more risky than the 2030 or the 2020, which means you're retiring, this time around here now. Slide number 13, specialty funds. Folks, for the most part, you want to stay away from these guys, okay, because they're for a few individuals. Maybe you might be interested in a REIT fund, but I'll tell you about the problems with them. But hedge funds aren't even mutual funds. They go by a very different law. They were traditionally only open to sophisticated investors. I don't even know where they got the name hedge from. But they should call them dangerous funds because they're very risky and sky high operating expenses. And you were supposed to have at least $100,000 to lose and you wouldn't be crying in your beer. But now people with $5,000 or $10,000 can get involved in these things. And they some of them are quite good, folks, but there are hundreds of them that are horrible. And so I just tell people, stay away. I certainly stay away. But you might have heard of Bridgewater. Is it Bridgewater? I forget. The Ray Dalio. Look up Ray Dalio, D-A-L-I-O. He's kind of made a name for himself as being a little bit controversial. He's just a regular guy. And if you read or listen to his interviews, watch his interviews, he's quite concerned about the United States. And he thinks if we don't get our act together and stop, fighting one another, we're in deep kimchi. And I tend to agree with him in that respect. We have a certain population that believes unbelievable things, just unbelievable, that Democrats eat babies in the basement of a pizza shop somewhere in Washington. I mean, it's, people believe this. They actually believe that. And so check out that hedge fund, but don't, just stay away from them. Bear funds. These are mutual funds that try to make money when the market goes down. How do you do that? Well, I don't want to get into it, but you can make money when stocks go down. The problem is stocks go up about three times more often than they go down. So bear funds have a very difficult time during normal times. They look great when the market goes down, but that's about the only time. You can buy mutual funds that invest in gold and other precious metals and commodities. We'll talk about those in our next chapter. But again, for the vast majority of us, no, we want to stay away from these. Now, REITs, real estate investment trusts, are actually something that you may be interested in if you want to be a landlord but not have to deal with tenants and not have to buy properties. You can buy a mutual fund that invests in real estate investment trusts. And what are these real estate investment trusts? Well, we'll discuss them in our next chapter when we also get the precious metals and commodities. They are the companies. Well, they're not really companies. They're trusts. So the legal framework is different. But for you and me, it looks basically the same as a stock. And so these are the trusts. These are the companies that own malls and shopping malls and apartment complexes and office buildings and warehouses and the like. And the problem is, there's just not that many of them. So you're going to have a fairly concentrated portfolio in a small number of companies. But you will do well if in real estate does well. You will, and they some of them have been very good investments over the years, and some of them have been, very mediocre. So if you really, really, really want to learn more about REITs, stick with us for the next presentation. But also contact me, because REITs can be good investments, I think. They're not as sexy as stocks, but they look like stocks, so that puts them in the equity income category, and they're more income oriented. And then, dear students, are the boutique and exotic funds. There's the stock car stocks funds. Now, what do you think they invest in? I have a hard time believing this, dear students, but the truth is the largest spectator sport in the United States is not football, it's not baseball, it's NASCAR. Right. Every weekend, 200,000 people get together and watch cars go around the track at 200 miles an hour. And what do you see on every car and every baseball cap and every jersey? Right, advertising. And if Folgers is the official coffee of the NASCAR, then that's what they buy. They buy Folgers. And so this mutual fund invests in the companies that sponsor NASCAR. And then there's the Paws Tombstone Fund. Now, Paws was the name of the mutual fund family. Tombstone was the fund. What do you think they invest in? No, not pizza, not tombstone pizza, but cemeteries and caskets and mortuaries. And, well, everybody's going to die someday. And thankfully, so did the Paws Tombstone Fund. And now you cannot make this up. You can't. There was a mutual. Look it up on the internet if you don't believe me. The Chicken Little Grow Fund. For people who are afraid that the sky is falling. There was, I don't know if it's still around, the Timothy Fund for good Christians, because somewhere in the letter from Paul to Timothy, he talks about capitalism. I don't know. Check it out. There's a fund just for Muslims, because Muslims are not allowed to lend money or borrow money. Christians didn't used to be allowed to do this either. That's why the Jews were around to say, okay, we'll lend you money. And a crazy world, right? And, but now Christians are allowed to lend money and borrow money, but the Muslims don't. So they have special contracts that they enter in, which are basically lending money, but not quite, not the same. So they get away with that. And there was a mutual fund that invested in them. I don't know if it's still around. The choices are endless. So are the fees. So forget all the slides. Forget all the mutual funds on this slide. Stay away from them. Slide number 14. Okay, finally, we get back to index funds. We discussed those in the previous presentation, and they are becoming the absolute fail-safe best way to invest. Can't lose. Oh, whenever I start to hear that, whenever you start to hear that, realize, uh-oh, something's brewing. Something's not right. Something's going to fall. Remember that we talked about management. And professional money management was one of the reasons we really love mutual funds. Well, index funds have no management because there's nothing to manage. Somebody puts out a list of 500 companies like the Standard & Poor's 500 or the IFA, MSCI, all the representative companies outside the United States, or the U.S. Total Stock Market Index, which used to be called the Wilshire 5000, actually, it's not 5,000 stocks anymore. I think it's about 3,500 or whatever. It's meant to represent the entire large cap, mid cap, and small cap companies. Somebody puts out a list, whether it's Standard & Poor's or Dow Jones or Morgan Stanley Capital International or Russell or Wilshire, and the mutual fund managers, all they have to do is read through the list and buy the companies that are on the list. And if it's not on the company, you don't buy it. It's that simple. Why is that popular? Well, because they will usually, but not always, watch out. They'll sneak, the insurance companies especially will do this. They will sneak in index funds into your 401k that have high operating expenses. Why do they do this? Because they can. And they're getting a big kickback out of that. But most index funds are going to have much lower annual operating expenses. And the truth is, that many actively managed funds do not beat the index. Well, why is this? Well, there's various reasons. One of the first ones is that the index doesn't have any fees associated with it. It's just a list of stocks. Whereas mutual fund managers are highly talented, very competitive, paid well, and if they're doing their job right, it costs a lot of money to go all around the world to have a global research team So right there, you got expenses that have to be paid for. And some managers just aren't that good. And so they just don't do very well. But then there are other managers that we saw, some of them, who have done much better than the indices over decades. So again, they're the people that I want to manage my money. And index funds have become victims of their own success. We have a few different instances of that. But right now, what is it? I know what it is. We just had a big election. November 2020. Right now, the S&P 500 index, 500 companies. Actually, it's like 504, but whatever. Basically, 500 companies, the largest companies based in the United States. So you think, well, you're very well represented if you have 500 companies. Folks, the top 10 companies make up over 25% of the index. These are companies that are absolutely monstrously huge. Valuations that we never thought possible 20, 30, 40 years ago. And you know them all. Most of them all. Apple, Facebook, Google, Netflix. Who else? Amazon, I'm sorry. They're called the Fangs. Now you got Microsoft in there. Fang buzzes. And I'm not trying to say they're not good companies, but you think you are incredibly well diversified with 500 different companies. Yeah, but 10 of them make up over 25%. The top 50 make up over 50% of the market. You see the difference? Many of the other companies are just much, much smaller. So they make up less of the index. Plus, here tells you something about what happens when index funds have to do what the market tells them to do. When a company gets more and more worth value, the value goes up, the price goes up, the valuation goes up, the mutual fund manager must buy more of it to represent that part of the fund. But they are not allowed to do any judgment. They can't say, you know what, this company is a great company, but it's way overvalued. They can't sell. They have to buy more. And so it tends to be a feedback mechanism. They buy more, the price goes up higher. So now they have to buy more. So you see, it spirals upward and blows up, spirals upward and blows that balloon higher and higher. The same thing happens on the way down. If a company is hit on hard times, the mutual fund manager in the index fund must sell more of that. They cannot allow that part of their portfolio to be more within, I think they have a certain range they can work with, but still they must sell. They can't say, you know what, this is a great company and it's hit on hard times and now's a great time to buy. No, they have to sell. So it makes you do the exact opposite of what a prudent manager of money would do. You want that prudent manager to buy low, sell high, whereas the index has to do the opposite: sell high, buy low. And you'll hear people say, "Well, Piano's a goofball. It doesn't happen that often." Sure, it doesn't happen that often, but when it does happen, it can be catastrophic. And we go into detail in the Business 123 Introduction to Investments class. But just suffice to say, it's happened throughout the history of index funds, and it's going to happen again. And just let people tell you that this is the fail-safe, perfect way to invest, and nod your head and realize that Piano told you there's no perfect way to invest. Every investment has advantages. Every investment has disadvantages. And leave it at that, because nothing's perfect. Nothing we humans have ever done is perfect. Get close. You can get pretty darn close. But not perfect. And as we said, many funds do beat their index over decades. So you're going to look for a fund family where most all their funds have consistently beaten the indexes over decades. And there's only a few out there. And a few of them are on the website and in Canvas for you to peruse. And you decide which ones they are. Okay. Index funds. Now, ETFs, as we said, came after index funds. And the success of index funds has bred a whole new type of mutual fund called the ETF, the exchange traded fund. Now, these guys work differently than regular mutual funds, because a regular mutual fund, the ones we talked about, the actively managed, and then the index funds, can only be bought and sold once a day, and you go through the mutual fund company. But here, the ETFs on the exchange can be bought and sold throughout the day. You can buy them and sell them, unlike other mutual funds, which only trade at the end of trading day close, right? And so these things have actually become trading vehicles for many people. Now, the original folks who started them, they're probably just going, oh, gee, that's not what we just meant for them to be. But that's what they've become, because you trade them on the exchange like a stock. So you now can reduce the operating expenses to less than what the index funds even charge, because they don't have to deal with any of the accounting. The brokerage firms do that for them. The exchanges do that for them. But you then incur brokerage fees. Well, you know, Fidelity and Vanguard, they're not stupid. They now have created their own brokerage firms, and they're not the same company. It's a sister company. But if you go through Vanguard's or Fidelity's, or I guess one of the others, I'm not too familiar with the others, but you go through their brokerage firm and buy their ETFs, they waive, W-I-A-I-V-E, you know, not the ocean wave, but the W, they throw out the brokerage commissions. Smart? Yeah, very, very smart. Fidelity is no dummy. And Fidelity, I'm not sure if anybody else has followed suit yet, Fidelity has actually waived the operating expenses for just a handful, just a few, less than, I think it's three of their ETFs. In other words, you can buy and sell these things for free and not get paid an annual expense ratio. Now, they can't do that forever, right? And they can't do that for everything. So what it's called a loss leader, if you folks are into marketing. They're basically saying, come on, buy these three. And by the way, look at us what we have. And then you'll buy other stuff that generates income for them, because they can't do that for everything, or they wouldn't be in business. So right now, most all ETFs are index funds, which means, again, there's no manager. That's how they can afford lower fees. But there are some ETFs that are actively managed, and there probably will be more in the future, which means you're going to have to pay for the people in the top hats. So they're going to have higher fees because of the active management. But they are, again, the index funds and the ETFs, which are basically lumped in together with one another, even though they're traded differently, are the fail-safe superlative way to invest these days. And many of the brokers have said, oh, they see all the handwriting on the wall. Okay, if I want to get more clients, I gotta basically tell my client, but prospective clients, how wonderful ETFs are, and I'll charge them 1-2% every year on top of what the ETF or the index fund charges, and you'll wind up spending a whole lot more than if you just got the... Anyway, you see, I'm a bit of a curmudgeon. First of all, old, right? So I look at things a little bit more jaded than people who just come into this new and say, well, everybody's going to this. This must be the way to go. And I think, I don't think so. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. And expect, if you go to a broker, that they will talk about the ETFs that they manage and the index funds that they manage and the annual operating expense, the wealth management fee that they charge you. Cool? So I know. It's only, what, 7 slides? But it's a lot. And I want you to go back over and study these and look at that scramble sheet and study the different categories. Because remember, you, dear students, are the investment guru for your friends and family and coworkers. And it is a very important responsibility. You can't let them down. In our last presentation on mutual funds, we will take a look at some fund families and a few other odds and ends, but then we will concentrate on a single mutual fund. and show you how this one mutual fund, not that I'm trying to get you to buy that individual mutual fund, but how this one mutual fund has been around for over 80 some odd years and done well in good times and bad times, and there are a whole lot more like it. Okay? See you in our final presentation on mutual funds, dear students.